For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we're examining some new cases inspired by classic detective series. Mick Finlay introduces us to Arrowwood, his down-at-heel Victorian gumshoe. Stella Duffy confesses to being delighted but daunted at being asked to complete an unfinished mystery by Nio Marsh. Mitch Cullen imagines what a 93-year-old Sherlock Holmes might be working on. And N.B. Dixon reviews a new case for Hercule Poirot. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Sherlock Holmes is probably the world's most famous literary detective, and his character continues to cast a long shadow over crime writers. But it's a challenge that Mick Finlay seems to relish. His Victorian detective, William Arrowwood, is the poor man's Sherlock Holmes, and Arrowwood makes no secret of his contempt and envy of his more famous rival. With his publication of the fourth book in the series, Arrowwood and the Meeting House Murders, I felt it was high time to cross-examine their author. Mick Finlay, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Now, for any of the listeners who haven't yet come across William Arrowwood, please could you introduce him to us?
Yes, sure. William Arrowwood lives in 1890s London. He's a private detective and he lives on the south of the river. And that's important because there's another more famous detective than him living on the north side of the river, which, of course, is Sherlock Holmes. So he actually lives in Sherlock Holmes's world, although he never actually meets him. But he's very, very aware of him. And Sherlock Holmes irritates him intensely because he's much more famous than he is. He earns more money from his cases and everybody considers him a genius, which William Arrowwood doesn't consider him to be. So Arrowwood himself picks up cases from people who really can't afford to pay him very much. Sometimes they can't afford to pay him at all. And he ends up investigating the type of crimes that Sherlock Holmes would not investigate. So these are the sort of grittier crimes in the seedier side of London. So, for example, in the first Arrowwood book, they involved Fenian terrorists and what was called the Maiden Tribute, which was the cross-channel trade in young girls for sexual purposes, which was a huge scandal at the time. And these are the sorts of cases that Arrowwood gets himself involved in, which you don't find featuring in the Sherlock Holmes novels.
And he's a wonderfully Hogarthian character. He's purple in the face and he's got a big overhanging belly. He's quite often drunk. And he lives in poverty in Coin Street in an increasingly overcrowded house. And I really get the sense that you're wanting to reflect just how cheap and precarious life in Victorian London really was.
Yeah, that was really important to me. I was trying to imagine how I would feel if I was suddenly transported into Victorian London and what the sort of sights and smells and sounds would appear to me. And I suppose the first thing I thought of, well, this is a very dirty place. It is overcrowded. Unless, of course, you live in one of the wealthier areas and you have a lot of money. For most Londoners, it was overcrowded. It was cold. It was dirty. The food was very often off and or watered down and adulterated. And people who didn't have steady jobs would very much be living a precarious existence and would sort of be scrabbling to find money and often living hand to mouth. And so when I thought of sort of what would be the opposite of a Sherlock Holmes detective, maybe a more realistic detective, I tried to put those characteristics into Arrowwood's life.
Yes, I keep finding myself wanting to lead him to a bathhouse and give him a good old wash when I'm reading the books. Now, in this latest book, The Meeting House Murders, you deal with the rather unpleasant subject of freak shows in London, and in particular, the four black men who are trying to escape from a rather vicious freak show run by Bruno Capaldi. And this deals with race and also the excesses of the British Empire.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a huge social and historical issue that I was delving into here. And it actually was quite a difficult book to write as a result. But it's actually inspired by a true story. which I read in the Illustrated Police News. And this was a case that came to a London magistrate's court in 1879, where five Zulu men appeared in front of the magistrate. And they had been billed to appear as part of a troupe called Farini Zulus, as part of what they called an ethnic exhibition. And freak shows and ethnic exhibitions often happened in the same bill in theatres and so on. But this was a real group of men who were appearing at the London Aquarium, which was this massive glass structure opposite the Houses of Parliament, which is now, I think, where the Methodist Central Hall currently is. And they were appearing in court because they were refusing to perform as Farini Zulus. Now, only one of them spoke English, and that was a very broken English. So they couldn't really cope very well on their own in London because of the language problems. And what had happened was, in South Africa, they'd signed a contract with a French showman to appear in Paris in a similar exhibition. When they got to Paris and performed, they discovered that the French showman had sold on the contract to an English showman called Mr. Farini, who had taken them to London to perform at the Royal Aquarium. And then when they got to London, they found that the showman was holding them under guard and refusing to let them leave the house in case people seeing them on the street affected ticket prices. To me, when I read this, I thought, oh my goodness, what a story. And because I like to have the Arrowood books, each of them to sort of center around a really important social or historical issue, I thought this is an absolutely intriguing world we're opening up here. And also, it shows just one aspect of how British colonialism and the empire returns to London streets. And you find these men, the real story, these five Zulu men, the magistrate told them to go back and work for Farini and exhibit themselves. Only one of them did so. The other four disappeared. And they surfaced every now and then in the police courts over the next year or so. But they never went back and performed as Farini Zulus. So I decided to use that story as a starting point. But that, of course, led to a huge amount of research that I had to do. I had to understand the history of Zulus, the history of the British Empire in South Africa. It was really important to me. These are crime novels. So I had to work out a plausible backstory for the group of Zulu men who I invented. I didn't use the same Zulu men. I had to sort of work out, well, what crime could this story be about? And I discovered this incredible bandit gang who operated around Cape Town at that time called the Ninevites. And they were a black resistance to the British authorities, but they were also criminals and they robbed black people as well as white people. But I decided that the Zulus in my story would be sort of runaways from this gang. So it really opened up a huge area of history. And also, it opened up the experiences black men would have faced in Victorian London in the streets, black men with no money particularly. It was a huge challenge to write, but I felt, I mean, particularly given the political climate at the moment, it seemed to be the right story to write right now.
And of course, Arrowood, being at the bottom of white society himself, feels a lot of sympathy with the Zulus that he is, well, trying to help escape from this travelling freak show. And it draws him into a world of violence where Arrowood is pitting his understanding of human nature. His deductive methods are based on psychology, on observing people. And in that way, he does have similarities with Sherlock Holmes, but in a way that is more familiar to us rather than the giant leaps of deduction that Holmes makes.
Yeah, absolutely. I had the idea of the character of William Arrowood before I had a story for the first book, and I wanted him to be the anti-Sherlock Holmes. So he had to have some method of solving crimes which didn't rely on examining cigarette ash and the type of clay on a carpet. Because I work in an academic department as a psychologist part-time, before I became a writer, I was a full-time psychologist, either working in the NHS as an assistant psychologist or doing research and teaching psychology. I decided I would make him use the psychological theories of the day to try and solve his crimes, which led me to some really fascinating reading about how Victorians understood human psychology, and then trying to get him to apply some of these ideas, many of which were completely wrong. It was just fun, really. But there's some great classic things which he likes to apply. So, for example, there was a book called that Gustave Le Bon wrote about crowds, and it was sort of the first book about crowd psychology. But Le Bon, who was a French aristocrat and very much fearful and suspicious of crowds, particularly crowds of poor people, decided that when crowds assembled, a collective madness ensued. And this was because emotions transmitted through the air from one person to another as if they were infectious diseases. And he believed that emotions were transmitted by some form of magnetism. And so Arrowood is sort of taken up with this idea and believes that, you know, he very much tries to sense out people when he's talking to them, when he's interviewing them, and he tries to pick up on their emotions. And he believes he's picking up by magnetism, but actually he's probably picking it up by all the nonverbal cues that we normally do. But he's very much attuned to this and very much trying to do it. So that's just one example of the Victorian psychology he uses. But he does use a range of other things. And there's a lot of Victorian psychology he doesn't agree with, such as Lombardo's criminology, which relies on identifying facial features, like a counterfeiter might have a particularly large nose and things like this. Oh, the criminal anthropologists of the day had this whole scheme of looking at people's eye shapes and their hairiness of their faces and thinking that they could identify different criminal types. So he's very much dismisses this, saying there's no evidence. And also the racial sciences of the day, he dismisses that as well. But there are other types of Victorian psychology which he does try and use. And he sort of stumbles towards the solutions through these, even though sometimes they're not quite right.
Now, every great detective needs a fantastic sidekick. And we have a man mountain in Norman Barnett, the Bermondsey-born companion through whom we see William Arrowood. Barnett is Arrowood's Watson.
Yeah. I mean, I did model that relationship on Holmes and Watson. But again, if Arrowood has to be different from Sherlock Holmes, then I decided Barnett had to be very different from Watson. The stories are narrated by Barnett, as they are by Watson, but Barnett is from the slums. So he's from a part of Bermondsey, which was notorious slum. He's had a terrible life up until the point that he, well, probably still when he starts working with Arrowood, it's still terrible. But it was pretty awful when he grew up. It was a very brutal neighbourhood. He had to do a lot of things that he deeply regrets in order to survive those years. But he's very sensitive about people being critical of the working classes. So when he goes about his work with Arrowood, when they have to interview people who make derogatory comments about people because they're poor, Barnett really feels that. And he also sees Arrowood's pomposity and sometimes Arrowood's unpleasant attitudes. And sometimes he calls him out on it, but other times he just observes it. But yeah, he is the guy who takes the beatings for Arrowood. He doesn't earn as much money. He's living even more precariously than Arrowood's living. But of course, they are friends, despite the sort of difference in power between them. Just as Holmes and Watson were friends, they do love each other, really. And they'll never really leave each other. And they're stumbling through life from case to case, relying on each other for support.
And Norman Barnett's voice is brought brilliantly to life in the audiobook versions by Malk Williams. Did you have anything to do with his selection as a narrator?
Malk is fantastic because although Barnett is narrating the novels, there's so much dialogue in it. He has to put on lots of different voices. I mean, I didn't realise what a difficult job being a voice actor was until I started to talk to Malk about his work. And he's done all four of the books. And he's really terrific. In the second book, which features a character with Down syndrome and another man with learning disabilities who has a really, really difficult speech impairment, Malk, he was sort of saying, OK, I've never done the voice of somebody with Down syndrome before. And he was trying them out. And the alignment of the mouth and tongue in people with Down syndrome creates certain characteristic vocal patterns. And so we were looking online for videos of people with Down syndrome talking to the camera and stuff. And Malk was trying to do this. And with the Zulu voices, he identified, there's a great website which has examples of English dialects from around the world. And he'd found a Zulu speaker from the particular area that these five Zulus had come from. speaking, and he'd worked out what are the characteristic vocal patterns, and he was doing that. And he has to do everything, you know. He's done Irish voices, he's done Russian voices, he's done French voices. I mean, I didn't realize how difficult I was making it for him, but he's terrific. I was slightly worried when I wrote this book because I'm not entirely comfortable as a white man writing black voices, because it's such a sensitive issue, and I really didn't want to get it wrong. And I didn't even think about Malk's position on this, because if you were a TV actor, a white actor would never act a black character. But when you're narrating a book, which is polyvocal, so he's voicing 20, 30, 40 different characters in this book, you can't have a different actor doing each one, because then it's not a talking book, it's a play. And the publishers, that would be an astronomical budget to do any talking book. So I wondered, well, what is the position amongst vocal actors about this issue? But we did have a long discussion with it, and he's discussed this many times over the years with the other voice actors. And it appears to be in the world of voice acting and talking books, it's just expected that as long as the main speaker in the book, the narrator, is not a completely different ethnicity to you, if some of the characters are, then that's acceptable. But yeah, I hadn't thought about that at all when I was writing the book. It was an interesting issue.
You have written research papers into disability, and one thing that I think comes through very strongly in your books is just how prevalent and visible disability was in Victorian London, whereas now possibly society prefers to hide away its disabled members.
Yes, I think that's true. One reason is that poor disabled people had to make a living. So they had to get out onto the streets of London to make a living in whatever way they could. There wasn't that system of where people could work at home. We didn't have computers. There wasn't a welfare system. So people had to get out. Of course, some disabled people were hidden away. And of course, the huge asylum system hid away people with mental health problems and people with learning disabilities. But medical treatments were far inferior in those days. So you had a lot more, for example, amputees on the streets of London, and they were much more visible as amputees as well, because we didn't have the technology in those days. There were many people with disabilities maybe begging, for example. I don't know if this is actually true, but what it strikes me that in terms of novels is that often the way in which disability might feature in a current day novel would be the disability is the centerpiece of that novel, or you get one character maybe with disability in the novel. But often novels don't have anybody with disability in them. And if you sort of say, well, what proportion of characters in modern novels have disabilities? I think it would probably be a smaller proportion than in real life. But for me, Victorian London was a place absolutely full of disability. And if you start reading accounts of street life, you do find this. I mean, we were fighting wars all the time, and there were soldiers coming back with disabilities, with no way of earning a living. Often you'd find them busking on the streets, or forming bands, or begging on the streets, or selling wares in the streets. So it was very visible. And I don't think we have that volume of soldiers coming back nowadays with visible disabilities. So I absolutely agree that it was much more visible in those days, despite the fact that there were these asylums which hid people away.
Now, we've discussed some pretty weighty issues so far.
Yes, we have.
These books are also great fun. There is a wonderful sense of irony in these books, and the constant threat that Sherlock Holmes might appear around the corner and just sweep past Arrowood and Barnett. I assume that they are equally good fun to write.
I really enjoy writing them. Reading the history is wonderful. I just feel such a privilege that I can do that. I'm not having to read about forensic science. I'm reading about Victorian social history, and that is great. I love that. But I suppose my greatest pleasure is the characters themselves, because now Arrowood is sort of in this extended family, because he's got his best friend Lewis, who's a Jewish secondhand arms dealer with one arm. There's his sister, Etty, who's a very moral Christian, who he lives with. And now also he lives with his ex-wife, both of whom had babies in the fourth book. There's a street girl from a previous case who's 6 years old, who's moved in with him as well. He's only got one bedroom, of course. So they're all living in this house together. The man with Down syndrome from book 2 is now living with Lewis, his best friend. And we've got Norman Barnett himself, and his love life is a constant theme throughout the book. So there's this group of people who are moving through all the books, and I just love working on their relationships and having things happen. And they get annoyed with each other, they fall out, they challenge each other morally, but they, of course, all love each other in the end. I love writing the crime aspect of it, but I think I love even more writing the way in which their relationships are changing throughout these books.
There are echoes of Shardlake in that relationship, and also in the setting in London, although separated by a few hundred years. Which detective novels inspired you when you were thinking about the series?
When I was a young man, I was a Raymond Chandler devotee, and I read everything, including all his letters. I just loved his world. His books were very short, which I really liked as well. And his style of writing, the way he used language, was simple but elegant and beautiful. Still, for me, I guess he's my crime writing hero. So that is what drew me to crime writing, definitely. In terms of historical crime, I really like Kate Summerscale's real-life crime examinations that she writes. I mean, they're so vivid and so full of detail that I guess, in terms of historical crime, that was the one that really got me going with Victorian crime.
And a major character in this series is also London itself. And I know that for a time you ran a market stall on the Portobello Road. And I wondered if that was the ideal apprenticeship for writing about what goes on the streets of London.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. But yes, it was actually. I spent 5 years and I was on Portobello Market every Saturday. And then I spent 3 years of that. I was at Greenwich Market on a Sunday as well, selling T-shirts. And I had to get there at about 6 a.m. and didn't finish until 5 or 6 p.m. So it was 12 hours. In a very busy street, and I knew who the pickpockets were, I knew how they operated, I had people stealing from my stall, chase people down the street who I saw stealing from me, I had people with forged checks, I had these little teams of people who would come up, and usually two women and one man, and they'd buy like a huge amount of t-shirts and sweatshirts from me and bring out a checkbook. I did take checks and then try to forge the check from the bank card that they'd also stolen. And I had that. I had a gang who preyed on me for about 6 months, this shoplifting gang. And I couldn't understand it. At the end of every day, I would be like 6 t-shirts down, and they would do it week in and week out. And they just disappeared. And I'd never worked out who they were, but I knew somebody was coming back every week and stealing quite a large part of my takings. And then about 2 years later, I was standing outside the stall early one morning, and this big guy came up and he leaned against the wall beside me and he said, "Anyone nick your t-shirts today yet?" And I said, "No." And then he explained to me, he said, "I've just come out of prison. We used to steal you from your stall every single week." And he introduced himself to me. So it was, you know, I did see a lot of things on that stall. Which probably did, yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, that really was a good education.
Well, they feed wonderfully into the Arrowwood series. Mick Finlay, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thanks a lot.
All 4 books in the Arrowwood series are available from the RNIB Talking Books Library, thanks to the generosity of publisher HarperCollins. And Mick Finlay will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
If you need someone who understands sight loss, we're here for you. Our free and informal Living Well with Sight Loss courses aim to help you increase your independence, boost your confidence, and connect with others to share experiences. Join a course by visiting rnib.org.uk/livingwellwithsightloss or call us on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Stella Duffy picks up where Nio Marsh left off, and N.B. Dixon reviews a new story inspired by Agatha Christie. But first, A Slight Trick of the Mind is a novel by Mitch Cullen, featuring a 93-year-old Sherlock Holmes. It was made into a film with Ian McKellen in the role of Holmes.
Robert donned his deerstalker to investigate further.
His name is Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Was that him? Have you ever been bitten?
Stung. Please don't have teeth.
You ever been bit?
No, I have never been bit.
Mr. Holmes, are you all right?
All right, Roger.
The photograph is her, isn't it? The woman in the story. Is it real?
The case was my last.
We're about to start an investigation.
Based on the novel A Slight Trick of the Mind by Mitch Cullen, who joined me in the Talking Book Studios to tell me about the book.
Slight Trick of the Mind is a novel, a literary novel, I should say. It's not necessarily a genre piece about Sherlock Holmes as an elderly gentleman living at his farmhouse in Sussex, having a very solitary life. He's 93 and he's tending his bees and working on some books that he's doing. And his memory is beginning to fade out on him, as it does to some people as they get older, which also brings into the mix some mysteries and some kind of lost threads from the past that he's trying to deal with and revisit while he can.
How much of the Conan Doyle source material did you read to get your Sherlock Holmes?
Well, you know, a lot, actually. It was important in order to write this version of the character, to take the kind of liberties that I wanted to take with him, I felt that it was pretty important then that I did my homework well. Mm-hmm. So I had known the stories as a boy. I had read them. I was very familiar with them from my childhood. So I wanted to create a more authentic version of... I was running on the idea that Sherlock Holmes really did exist. So I was going to follow it to its logical or illogical conclusion, depending on how you feel about these things. And so it was important that there was no elementary My Dear Watson kind of moment, or that he was wearing a deerstalker hat, which he didn't in the Conan Doyle stories, and that he wasn't smoking a big meerschaum pipe. But yeah, it was important for me to get as much of the details right, so that way I could then also embellish and create my own kind of story about him.
Now, you used the phrase taking liberties. Were you a bit worried when the book came out that fans of Sherlock Holmes wouldn't enjoy it?
Indeed, I was actually. Only after I finished writing it and it was set to come out, I felt a lot better when one of the foremost authorities on Sherlock Holmes, a man named Leslie Klinger, who did the new annotated Sherlock Holmes, wrote a book review of it for the Los Angeles Times Book Review and was a very, very positive review. I think after that, I felt a lot better about how it would be received. With the Holmes, the real serious Holmes scholars, I tend to, I think they appreciate the work I put into it and kind of understand what I was trying to do. I've called them the kind of casual, earnest Sherlock Holmes fans. It's been mixed. Some have been very mad at me. I've received some angry mail, kind of is of the nature of, why would you do this? Why, who, you know, how dare you? And I understand it. My reply to them is always, you know, it's fiction, and you're always free to write your own version of Sherlock Holmes reading this book and not liking it, and you know, but for the most part, I've had a very good response to it.
Now, there's a movie version. Were you excited when you heard Ian McKellen was going to be cast?
Can you imagine? I was delighted. It was a fantastic day, and I thought I was dreaming. He's the perfect man for it. I think he'll bring the poignancy to it and the intelligence to it that I think will do justice. And it's a really, Bill Condon is directing it, and he had worked with Ian McKellen on Gods and Monsters, so it's a reunion of those two guys. I think it's just going to be a fine, fine film, and very different than the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock Holmes. It'll be a little more quiet, I think.
Mm. Now, photography is your background, and you said your writing is a continuation of your photography.
It's true, actually. I think if you look at the writing, when I write, I'm definitely thinking in terms of visual images, and often static visual images. It's just kind of the way my brain is trained. So when a single photograph can tell a story, and it can be one that the viewer can interpret in different ways depending on who they are, I think that sensibility came into the writing as well. I tend to try and write in a way that whoever's reading it, whoever they are, each individual can bring themselves into it in a way that they can make it their own, or at least perceive it in a way that aligns with their own perception of things, if I've done it well. Sometimes I've failed horribly at that attempt, but definitely I try to do it on some level.
Now, have you heard the audio version of it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. My gosh. See, this is why I don't like reading the book, because Simon Jones, he does such a great job at it, whereas I just sound like a hick. So, yeah, I think he's done a brilliant job with the audiobook.
I'll go back to that in a second, but did you ever consider reading it yourself?
They didn't ask me. They were probably they were probably smart not to. It actually was kind of serendipitous, because Simon Jones has, you know, he was on the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I think, radio show, and worked with the Pythons, worked with Terry Gilliam as well on a few things. So they kind of, things kind of connected in a way to Tideland and other things. So he seemed like the right guy for it. But no one wanted my, you know, my draw on it.
Now, going back to Simon Jones' reading of it, do you think the imagery comes across in his voice as well?
I do, actually. And I think he actually, his dramatic ability, which is unique, makes it almost a performance. When I first heard it, I realized, oh, it sounds much more poetic than I thought it would sound, through the way he reads it. So it's definitely a unique way to experience the book.
Excellent, Holmes said. You have summoned these creatures admirably, Roger. I am very pleased by your diligence here. Then, rewarding the boy, he removed the vial from his pocket, presenting it between a crooked finger and a thumb. This was meant for you, he said, watching as Roger accepted the container and gazed at its contents with mild wonder. Apis carana japonica, or perhaps we will simply call them Japanese honeybees. How's that? Thank you, sir.
Now, you're obviously American. How hard was it to write as an Englishman?
Very hard. A large portion of the book is in my voice, so the omniscient, I'll call it the omniscient voice. That's more my voice. The pastiche part of the book, which would be the section written by Holmes, was very difficult. And I wrote it with copies of Conan Doyle's books all around me, and not easy. Now, luckily, I had enough friends who are British who I could show it to, and they could laugh at certain things I had done completely wrong. And they did. But I defy anyone, whether you're an American or British or from wherever, to try and write in that way and not perhaps do it 100%. It wasn't easy. I'm glad I'll never have to do it again. It was difficult.
Yes, yeah, it's a myth that we share the same language.
Yeah, that's true.
And now, how important for you is it that your books are available to everyone, be it in audio, in Braille, or electronically on Kindle?
It's very important to me, because I don't really write for a specific audience. I'm writing for everyone, or hopefully I'm writing for everyone. And I want my books to reach as many people as possible. And so I want them out as audiobooks. I want them out in Kindle. I want them out in as many languages as possible. It sounds selfish, but it's not wholly selfish. I want them available to people everywhere.
Holmes gasped, waking. His eyelids lifted, and he glanced around the library while clearing his throat. Then he inhaled deeply, noting the slant of waning sunlight coming from a west-facing window. The resulting glow and shadow cast across the polished slats of the floor, creeping like clock hands, just enough to touch the hem of the Persian rug underneath his feet, told him it was precisely 5:18 in the afternoon.
Simon Jones there, reading A Slight Trick of the Mind by Mitch Cullen. It's published in the UK by Canongate, and it's available now in print on Kindle and in audio.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Mitch Cullen.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB. See differently.
This is Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Coming up soon in this crime story continuation special, N.B. Dixon will review a new Poirot mystery. But before that...
'Nio Marsh was one of the four queens of crime, alongside Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, and Marjorie Allingham. She helped create the golden age of crime fiction. Her sleuth, Inspector Roderick Allen, featured in 32 mystery novels, including A Man Lay Dead and A Surfeit of Lampreys. But she also left one unfinished work, titled Money in the Morgue. In 2016, Stella Duffy, a successful crime writer in her own right, was commissioned to finish the book. She proved to be an inspired choice. Stella Duffy, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the background to the book?
Yes. So, as far as we know, because there's not a lot of detail about it, she started it during the Second World War, maybe around 1942-43-ish. And she stopped writing, and we don't know why. And she didn't die till the 80s. So, it's not like she was writing this and then she died and that's why it didn't get finished. There are a couple of suggestions. Well, and she'd only written about 5,000 words as well. So sometimes people say Stella Duffy finished 'Nio Marsh's novel. And I'm like, well, she wrote 5,000 words and I wrote 85,000. It's not quite finishing, is it? And in fact, in her notes, there was very little information as well. So there was a lot of character names, a few possibilities. There was no whodunit, no wheredunit and no whydunit. So HarperCollins found a little bit more information about it, but again, no more detail about the plot. And they contacted me asking if I would consider doing it. I have written some crime novels, but I've also written literary fiction, historical fiction, contemporary fiction. None of the crime novels I've done have been traditional. They've not been like this, a locked door mystery. They've not been Golden Age by any means. So it was pretty daunting to be asked if I wanted to do it. But at the same time, I grew up in New Zealand and have been back. I was born in London, have been back here for over 33 years. 'Nio Marsh loved London, lived here a lot, was a New Zealander. 'Nio Marsh is a theatre director. The reason she is a dame, Dame 'Nio Marsh, is not for her writing work. In New Zealand, sadly, her writing work wasn't very well respected. They were quite snobby about crime fiction. People here can be snobby about crime fiction too, but it was particularly bad when she was at the height of her success, in fact, the 50s and 60s. Her damehood is for her amazing theatre work, and I've worked in theatre on and off since the early 1980s. And so I would have minded if they'd have asked somebody else. And so, of course, I had to say yes, but it was probably one of the scariest things I've ever said yes to.
Well, the more I dug into the notes about this, the more I discovered that you are actually the perfect person to have done this.
Well, I like to think I am. But at the same time, I have a couple of dear friends who are writers and who love her work and probably know her work an awful lot better than I do. I mean, in terms of the research, I'd read most of them, I think, when I was younger. I went back and looked at them. But knowing where this came, number 10 or 11 or 12 of her books, we have no idea where she meant it to come. Actually, I didn't read very heavily beyond this. So I went back, I looked at the books to make sure I knew Inspector Allen, I knew as much as I could. But knowing how some of the fans, of course, you know, they've read them all 15 times and they've read them many more times than I have and they're passionate about the character. So the idea that I would then have him holding the pipe the wrong way because he didn't start holding the pipe until 1966 in this way and I was writing a book set in 1943, it was really important to make sure I knew the first ones really well, but I didn't know the subsequent ones too well in case I got an anachronism in there.
Well, I will put up my hand and say that I was and still am a huge 'Nio Marsh fan.
Uh-oh.
And I was looking for the join. I was looking for where those 5,000 words ended and where you started. And I couldn't for the life of me find it. I cannot believe just how authentic it feels. And had I not known that you didn't just finish it off in inverted commas, I would have thought that she'd written the bulk of it already. So you clearly did a good job and you clearly thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did. Thank you very much for that. There were a couple of things that made it possible for me to say yes. One is that she hadn't plotted it all out because I think I'm not a jobbing writer. I'm, in fact, much to my publisher's dismay, I'm not capable of writing another version of the same book time after time. And I know people who do that so brilliantly and so successfully that their reader knows what they're going to get and yet it's a different novel. And that's amazing. Unfortunately, I'm not capable of doing that, which means that every new book is brand new, different and exciting for me, certainly harder for publishers to sell. attracts different audiences each time. So I don't think I could have done this very successfully if she'd plotted it all and I just had to fill in the gaps. What was brilliant was that HarperCollins were very generous. They gave me all the time in the world and they said, just go for it. I'm not a planner or a plotter, though, and she clearly is. These are three-act plays, and that's the structure she uses. So a lot of the work I did, and this I did across the board, not just in the first 10, 12 novels, I did it with all of them. I looked at the structure, and I looked really closely at how she was using the structure. And there are a bunch of things that she doesn't do it in every book, but she does it quite a lot. A lovely scene with Alan and a young woman who's gone astray, usually somewhere out in the countryside.
Quite often a Kiwi.
Quite often. Or an ingenue who's very badly behaved. Or somebody who's lying not because they're bad and wicked, but because they're trying to do right. Somebody who's lying because they are bad and wicked. One of the things I found really interesting is people often dismiss the Golden Age writers. And I've also directed a play that was about Margaret Rutherford and Agatha Christie and their relationship on the Margaret Rutherford, Miss Marple films. You know, those women, Sayers, Allingham, Christie and Marsh, they were phenomenally successful at a time when other women simply weren't being. They wrote women characters that weren't just tropes and weren't just ciphers, weren't just fitting, you know, one that fits the mould. And yes, they all have their patterns. But actually, readers like a pattern. Readers like second-guessing the author and then hoping they've got it right. And I also did a lot of work looking at Marsh's biographies. I read her autobiography. So she did one and then she revised it later in the 80s. And there's a couple of very good biographies. Margaret Lewis has an amazing one about her. And they were really important because I wanted to think, if I were her writing this, what would I do? And so I was trying to think of it from her perspective rather than from mine. But not to be a pastiche. I wasn't trying to ape her writing. I was trying to find a way that I could do her writing. The other thing that really helped is that in her notes, she did have the possibility of some soldiers. It's set in a hospital on the plains. It's a military hospital. Men have been sent back, young men, from the war. My dad joined the New Zealand Air Force in 1939. My uncle was in the Navy. My other uncle was in the Army. These guys in this book, who are only in their early 20s, are exactly the age and type of people as my dad and my uncles. And so when it came to writing them, I really knew the people I was writing about. And even though it's a completely different generation, I'm in my mid-50s, so it's only one generation away. And I grew up with my aunts and uncles and cousins, and when we moved to New Zealand in the 1960s, the war was still very close, and their experience of war was still very close. And it was completely different, totally different to the European experience. And so I knew that I could do that with a good deal of authenticity, and that really made it possible to say yes, actually.
Is this a once-only? There is not another Nio Marsh book waiting to be continued by you.
There's not another one waiting to be continued. HarperCollins would happily publish another one if I had one to do. I think I probably do. It would probably, possibly be a London one and probably, possibly be set in the 50s or 60s. It would have tiny bits of what I remember of having been born in 63, but certainly my siblings who were around in the 50s and 60s and are all in their late 60s and 70s now would be very good fodder for a book were I to do that. And I don't think that Roderick Allen has done quite enough in the working class areas of South East London, which I always love to write about because it's where I live now too. However, I have two books to do for my ongoing publisher, Virago, first. I mean, I do want to do it. HarperCollins would have it. I'm just not sure when I can fit it in.
I will be waiting with bated breath.
At about 8 o'clock, on a disarmingly still midsummer evening, Mr. Glossop telephoned from the transport office at Mount Seeger Hospital to his headquarters 20 miles away across the plains. He made angry jabs with his blunt forefinger at the dial, and to its faint responsive tinkling, an invisible curtain rose upon a series of events that were to be confined within the dark hours of that short summer night, bounded between dusk and dawn. So closely did these events follow the arbitrary design of a play that the temptation to represent Mr. Glossop as an overture cannot be withstood.
Now, one of the greatest joys of this is that you narrate it yourself.
I do, yes, I do. And that was the first time I've done an audiobook. I have been an actor. I've done lots of radio, certainly in this way, but I've also done radio stories and things like that. But reading my own, oh, it's agony, seriously. Partly because you're not allowed to change words, nor should you, because you want people who are listening to get the same experience as people who are reading. But of course, once you read anything out loud, you see things like going, oh God, I shouldn't have put that comma there, and I wish I hadn't done that. And I was so nervous beforehand. But a dear friend of mine, Patrick Gale, who's a brilliant novelist, and they're reissuing all of his books with him doing the audiobook of all of them. And I was talking to him about it, and he said, just make sure you pick your character voices well in advance so you don't change them in the middle of it. Take your time and trust the person in the studio. And I've been an actor, so I'm fine with being given notes. I want someone to tell me, you're being too fast, you're being too slow, pick it up, get on with that. I really welcome that. So when I came to do it, I had no sense of being the writer who knows better. I just let the bloke in the studio tell me everything, and I did what he said. And apparently it's all right. He said so anyway.
It's more than all right. Well, Stella Duffy, thank you so much for coming into the studio and telling us all about Money in the Morgue and more. And I can't wait to invite you back to hear about the next Nio Marsh book, maybe in a couple of years' time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Stella Duffy narrating Money in the Morgue, written by her and Nio Marsh, available as TB 702615. And you'll also find a range of other books by both Stella and Nio Marsh in the RNIB Library. For more information, visit the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Now, before we return to Mick Finlay to share the books of his life, here at Read On, we love to hear about the books that you've been enjoying. You can send in your suggestions and book reviews via email. Our address is radio@rnib.org.uk. And that's exactly what listener and author of the Outlaw's Legacy series, N.B. Dixon, did. Here's her review of another novel that continues a classic detective series.
Hello, this is N.B. Dixon with my review of the book The Mystery of Three Quarters by Sophie Hannah. It was recently featured on an episode of Read On, and it grabbed my attention, so I went straight away and got it out of the RNIB library. First of all, I should hold my hands up and say that until I read this book, I'd never actually read a single Agatha Christie novel. But I was gripped straight away by this story. I thought it was engaging, the style was really easy to read, and the characters just literally leapt off the page. I couldn't put it down. Julian Rhind Tutt is a fantastic narrator, and I thought his portrayal of Poirot in particular was brilliant. The French accent didn't sound exaggerated as it does with so many narrators. So all in all, I thought it was a great book. I then read the other two and then decided I would check out the originals. And I have to say, however blasphemous it may be, that I actually think Sophie Hannah's Poirot books are better than Agatha Christie's. So hopefully she won't come and haunt me from the grave for admitting that. But seriously, the book is great. So any Poirot fans, I'm sure, will love it. It's the third book Sophie Hannah has written, but each book is a standalone, so you can take them in any order, really. And it was my favourite of hers, so I'm really looking forward to the next book, which I believe will be out next year.
How dare you? How dare you send me such a letter?
Madam, pardon me, but I do not believe we know one another.
Don't act the part of the innocent with me. I am Sylvia Rule, as you know perfectly well.
Now I know, because you have told me. A moment ago, I did not know. You referred to a letter. Will you force me to repeat your slander of me in a public place? Very well, then, I shall. I received a letter this morning, a most disgusting and objectionable letter signed by you. She stabbed the air with a forefinger that would have poked Poirot in the chest had he not hopped to one side to avoid it. Non, madame. He tried to protest, but his attempt at denial was swiftly demolished.
in this travesty of a letter, you accused me of murder. Murder! Me, Sylvia Rule! You claimed that you could prove my guilt, and you advised me to go at once to the police and confess my crime. How dare you? You cannot prove anything against me, for the simple reason that I am innocent. I have not killed anybody. I am the least violently inclined person I have ever met, and I have never heard of a Barnabas Pandy.
Thanks to N.B. Dixon, The Mystery of Three Quarters by Sophie Hannah is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB703386, narrated by Julian Rind Tutt. And N.B. Dixon's Outlaws Legacy series of books is available commercially. Now it's back to Mick Finlay for the books of his life.
Mick, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yeah, there were a lot of books I could name here, but the one I've chosen is called The Ginger Man by J.P. Donlevy. And I read this book when I was about 15. It was published in 1955, and it was banned in the USA and Ireland for obscenity. And oddly enough, it was my mother who gave me this book as a birthday present. I don't think she realised its history, but I completely loved this book. It's a wild book about a rascal living in Dublin in 1947. And he's a drinker and a chancer, and he's an incredibly likeable character. And the book is funny and poetic, and I really did find it compulsive reading. I think it's also the first thing I'd read that really played with form. So lots of the chapters end with a couple of lines of poetry. This is something that Donlevy does in quite a lot of his other novels. But in the book, he also switches from first person to third person narrative, and he uses very, very short sentences with no verbs sometimes. And these are styles which are quite common nowadays, but I think were quite revolutionary back in that day. And this book has been described as one of the great post-war comic novels, and I would thoroughly recommend it. Anyone who wants to have a bit of a laugh and a very lovely picture of Dublin in 1947.
You get your check? Going to see about it Monday.
If mine doesn't come, I'll croak, and you're saddled with a wife and child. Wow. But at least you get it steady, and I've never got it at all. Any loose women out there on Howth? I'll keep a watch. Look, I've got to go and see my tutor and see if I can find out where they hold my Greek lectures. Nobody knows. Everything is secret. No more drink for me. I'll come out over the weekend. Kenneth, I might have your first woman waiting for you. Yeah.
Garrick Hagen, narrating The Ginger Man by J.P. Donlevy, which is available from the R&IB Talking Books Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yeah, I have chosen a book called Close Range by Annie Proulx. And this is a book of short stories which were published in 1999, which contain the Brokeback Mountain story that was turned into a film. Now, all the stories in the book are set in rural Wyoming, which is a bleak and unforgiving landscape, full of bright but tragic characters. And I think short stories are probably a good choice for a rainy day because they provide a variety that you might not otherwise get in a novel. Now, the stories in this book completely take you away from where you are, and they set you down in the plains and hills of the American landscape. The descriptions are beautiful, the characters are incredibly well drawn, and she has a way of depicting the depth of relationships that isn't labored, but is very, very affecting. And these are people struggling in a difficult landscape, but in it you see human spirit and resilience and complexity. I also love westerns and country music, by the way, so this sort of landscape really appeals to me.
In the long unfurling of his life, from tight-wound kid hustler in a wool suit, riding the train out of Cheyenne, to geriatric limper in this spooled-out year, Miro had kicked down thoughts of the place where he began. A so-called ranch on strange ground at the south hinge of the Bighorns. He'd got himself out of there in 1936, had gone to a war and come back, married and married again, and again, made money in boilers and air duct cleaning, and smart investments, retired, got into local politics and out again without scandal. Never circled back to see the old man and Rollo, bankrupt and ruined because he knew they were. They called it a ranch, and it had been. But one day the old man said it was impossible to run cows in such tough country, where they fell off cliffs, disappeared into sinkholes, gave up large numbers of calves to marauding lions, where hay couldn't grow, but leafy spurge and Canada thistle throve, and the wind packed enough sand to scour windshields opaque.
Peter Brook, narrating Close Range, Brokeback Mountain and other stories by Annie Prue, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, my choice here is Mr. Bowling Buys a Newspaper by Donald Henderson. Now, this was a book that was published in 1943, and it was recently republished in the Collins Crime Club series. I bought it because Raymond Chandler, who was a hero of mine, said it was one of his favourite books. It's set in London in the Second World War, and it's about a rather likeable serial killer who's disappointed that the police aren't better at catching him. And I realise this doesn't sound like a promising premise, but it is such an enjoyable read. It's laugh out loud funny at times. There's brilliant descriptions of how people lived in wartime London, particularly people who are sort of a little bit outsiders. And it also has this intriguing storyline. And if you do read that or have read it and you want another great story with a similar premise, I would also recommend Oyinkin Braithwaite's My Sister the Serial Killer, which has a vaguely similar premise but is set in Nigeria.
He got a glimpse of himself in the mirror there and thought, well, I don't know. I think I look rather decent. Across the bar, a girl sat with a soldier and said about Mr. Bowling, "There's that man who often comes in here. Don't he look awful? There's something about him." But over in Ebury Street, Victoria, the crowd thought he was marvellous. Queenie often said, "Oh, Lord, I'm fed up. Let's ring up poor old Bill. He'll cheer us up. At least he's a gentleman." She'd get busy dialing Park 4796. She did it now, and the others sat around with the Watney bottles. "Hello? Oh, could I speak to Mr. Bowling, please? Is it a trouble?"
Tim Francis narrating Mr. Bowling Buys a Newspaper by Donald Henderson, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Well, Mick Finley, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure. It's great to meet you, Red.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Redsail, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.